November 15th, 1986, Willow Creek, California. When a fire breaks out at the mobile home of 16-year-old twin sisters Jill and Julie Hansen, both girls receive shotgun blasts to the stomach, and while Jill dies at the scene, Julie passes away at the hospital 1 month later. Since evidence implicates their 21-year-old half-brother Donnie Hansen, he is charged with arson and murder and goes on trial for the crime. However, since eyewitnesses reported seeing two other unidentified men near the murder scene, this creates enough reasonable doubt for the jury to acquit Donnie, so there are no conclusive answers about who actually killed Jill and Julie. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I'm going to be covering a case from Unsolved Mysteries in which the victims were a pair of twin sisters, the 1986 murders of Jill and Julie Hansen. This was a pretty unique segment for the show because it aired after a suspect had already gone on trial for the crime and been found not guilty. In essence, it was almost like a reverse final appeal segment since a number of people still believed that the defendant got away with murder. Jill and Julie lived with their parents in a mobile home, but after a fire broke out in the middle of the night and burned the trailer to the ground, it would turn out that both sisters received shotgun blasts, which ultimately led to their deaths. At the time, the twins' half-brother, Donnie Hansen, was visiting from out of town and had spent the night at the trailer, but a lot of evidence would soon emerge that Donnie was responsible for the crime, and he may have intended to wipe out his entire family. While Donnie would go on trial for double murder, his defense team managed to create just enough reasonable doubt for the jury to vote not guilty, and because of double jeopardy, he could never be charged with this crime again. However, there was evidence to suggest that other people may have been at the murder scene that night, and if Donnie was not completely innocent, these people could have been his accomplices. Even if Donnie did not personally pull the trigger and shoot his sisters, he may have known who did. The circumstances of how this crime was carried out are so bizarre that it's really difficult to figure out what actually happened, but there may still be people out there who have yet to face justice for this crime. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murders of Jill and Julie Hansen. Our story begins in 1986 in Willow Creek, California, a small mountain town located in Humboldt County near Six Rivers National Forest, which had a population of around 1,000 people at that time. While this doesn't hold any relevance to today's featured case, I thought it was worth mentioning that Willow Creek is the self-proclaimed Bigfoot capital of the world, due to the many Bigfoot sightings which have taken place in the region, and the town also has its own Bigfoot museum and holds an annual Bigfoot Days Festival every September. While this may sound like a cliche, Willow Creek has been described as one of those tight-knit communities where everyone knows everybody else, and they would not have expected such an horrific crime to take place. Our victims in this story are Jill and Julie Hansen, a pair of 16-year-old twin sisters who live with their parents, Hans and Betty Hansen. Hans and Betty have been married for 18 years and moved their family to Willow Creek in 1971 so that Hans could operate his own logging supply business, and they currently live in a mobile home located next to the business's warehouse. Betty also has two older children from a previous marriage named Becky, who has since gotten married, and Donnie, who is 21 years old at this point, and living in the town of Fortuna. On the night this crime occurred, Donnie had stopped by the residence to visit his family and stayed over by sleeping on the living room couch. At around 3 a.m. on the morning of November the 15th, Betty and Hans were sleeping in the master bedroom when they were suddenly awakened by what they described as popping sounds, and they started smelling smoke. When they opened the bedroom door, they were shocked to discover that the trailer was now on fire and flames were burning in a long strip down the hallway. Hans immediately grabbed a fire extinguisher and attempted to douse the flames, and while he called out for Jill, Julie, and Donnie, he did not hear any response from them. When the extinguisher emptied, Hans exited out the back door, but he wound up kicking an empty gas can which was on the porch. Betty made an attempt to run down the hallway to check on her children, and finally saw Donnie next to the couch. He ran through the open sliding glass door while yelling, "Get out of here," but Betty could not see who he was shouting at. Jill and Julie slept together in the same bedroom, which was now blocked by flames, so Betty exited the trailer and ran to the warehouse, where a number of extra fire extinguishers were stored. Hans and Donnie soon joined her there, and Hans grabbed a ladder and took it back to the trailer, where he used it to break the window of the twins' bedroom. He yelled inside for Jill and Julie, but received no response, and by this point, the bedroom was engulfed in flames. Betty had already called the fire department, and the family kept going back and forth from the trailer to the warehouse to grab fire extinguishers and attempted to douse the flames. While this was going on, Hans asked Donnie if he had seen Jill or Julie anywhere, and he replied no. The fire department finally arrived at the scene to handle the situation, but one of the Hansen's neighbors noticed a body in a vacant lot across the road, and it turned out to be Julie, who was bleeding from a large wound in her abdomen. She was barely alive, so she was given immediate medical attention by paramedics and rushed to Mad River Community Hospital in the town of Arcata. Even though he had previously told Hans he never saw either of the girls, Donnie now claimed that he had gotten Julie out of the trailer himself, and when Hans asked how badly she was burned, Donnie didn't answer. Unfortunately, there was still no sign of Jewel, and no one would find out what happened to her until daylight hit. After the fire was completely put out, Jill's charred body was discovered in the trailer's rubble, but like her sister, she had a large hole in her abdomen. Paramedics had initially assumed that the wound in Julie's abdomen had been caused by an explosion, but once she went into surgery at the hospital, they realized that she'd been shot at point-blank range with a 12-gauge shotgun. The surgery took 6 hours to repair her internal organs, but Julie wound up surviving and remained in critical condition in the intensive care unit. It wasn't long before an autopsy confirmed that Jill had also been shot in the stomach. When police performed a forensic investigation of the scene, they discovered 3 shotgun shells and an empty 5-gallon gas can, in addition to the second empty gas can Hans had almost tripped over on the porch when he exited out the back door. A search was also performed of the warehouse, which was left undamaged by the fire, and a 12-gauge shotgun was found hidden behind some boxes. Ballistics tests would show that this was the same gun used to shoot Jill and Julie, and this conclusively proved that arson and murder had taken place. But since the Hansens were known for being a very friendly family in the community who did not have any known enemies, and the twins were very popular in school, no one could figure out a motive for this crime. However, the case went in an unexpected direction during the early morning hours of November the 17th. At the time, the Hansen property had been cordoned off by the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department, who kept it under surveillance. But the officer on duty was taken by surprise when Donnie showed up at the warehouse at 5 a.m. and tried to climb in through one of the windows. When the officer caught him and brought in the lead detective to question Donnie, he told them he had stopped by to feed the family dog, even though the dog had recently been placed in the care of some neighbors, and Donnie would have known this. The detective suspected that the real reason for Donnie's visit was because he wanted to retrieve the 12-gauge shotgun which had been hidden behind some boxes inside the warehouse, but he was unaware the police had already found it. It wasn't long before the investigation would uncover some pretty troubling evidence against Donnie. It turned out that the shotgun belonged to a friend of his, and Donnie had decided to borrow it only 3 days before the shooting. A search of Donnie's car would turn up some unspent shells, which matched the empty shells found at the crime scene, and Donnie had purchased these shells only hours before his half-sisters were shot. Credit card statements showed that Donnie also purchased 5 gallons of gasoline 2 days before the crime, and witnesses from the service station recalled seeing Donnie fill up a 5-gallon can, which was identical to the gas cans found at the scene. Julie continued to recover at the hospital, but 2 weeks after the fire, she finally started talking again. She told her parents and the police that she remembered being woken up by a noise and climbing over her sister, who was still asleep in their bed, and exiting their bedroom into the hallway. She then saw a flash and instantly collapsed to the floor after she was shot in the abdomen. Julie said she did not get a good look at the shooter, but she managed to escape the trailer while she was wounded and made it across the road to the vacant lot where she was found. While this contradicted the original story Donnie had shared with Hans, where he claimed that he pulled Julie out of the trailer himself. When pushed for more details, Julie revealed that she briefly recalled seeing Donnie's face in the flash of the gunshot. However, according to Julie's doctor, she had previously shared her story with him on multiple occasions and never mentioned Donnie, as she specifically said she saw no one. Donnie would be questioned by police on December the 2nd and continued to deny any involvement in the crime, but he wound up failing 2 polygraphs. However, he did finally admit that he had been keeping the shotgun inside his car, but panicked and decided to hide it in the warehouse while the fire was taking place because he feared he would be blamed for the crime. Regardless, investigators still believed that there was enough circumstantial evidence tying Donnie to the crime, so following a 2-hour interrogation, Donnie was arrested and charged with Jill's murder as well as arson. Unfortunately, tragedy would strike just under 3 weeks later on December the 19th, when Julie suddenly died at the hospital during a freak medical accident. Her intravenous feeding tube had become separated from her neck, causing an air bubble to enter her bloodstream, which resulted in an air embolism that stopped her heart. Donnie would be charged with a 2nd count of murder for his role in Julie's death, but since she could not be cross-examined by Donnie's defense attorneys, her story about seeing Donnie's face in the flash of the shotgun blast was ruled to be inadmissible as evidence at his trial. Due to the extensive publicity surrounding the case in Humboldt County, the defense felt it would be impossible to assemble an impartial jury, so they filed a motion for a change of venue. The motion was granted, so the trial would take place in Alameda County in April of 1988, and the Humboldt County District Attorney said he would seek the death penalty if Donnie was found guilty. The primary piece of evidence supplied by Donnie's defense team was eyewitness testimony from 2 of the Hansons' neighbors, who claimed that on the night of the crime, they saw 2 unidentified men standing outside the trailer while it was on fire. Witnesses also recalled hearing the sound of a car screeching down the street a short time later, and these men were not present when the police and fire department arrived. A few hours later, 2 men were seen walking near the crime scene and were briefly questioned by police, and while they claimed to have not been present when the fire took place, they appeared to have ashes on their clothing. The defense's theory was that these 2 unidentified men were the real perpetrators of the crime, and when they arrived at the scene at around 3 a.m., they found the shotgun, the shells, and the cans of gasoline Donnie had recently purchased inside his car. After picking the lock on the sliding glass door and breaking inside the trailer, they then proceeded to pour the gasoline all over the interior. At some point, Julie woke up and exited her bedroom into the hallway, so one of the intruders shot her. Since he was sleeping on the living room couch, Donnie was woken up by the shotgun blast, and after finding Julie's wounded body, he took her out onto the front porch before running over to the warehouse to help Hans and Betty grab fire extinguishers. While all this was going on, at least one of the intruders remained inside the trailer and fired a fatal shotgun blast into Jill. After running outside, the assailant placed Donnie's shotgun back inside his car, and the two men subsequently fled the scene in their own vehicle before the rest of the Hansen family saw them. Since Donnie was paranoid that he would be blamed for the shooting of his sisters, he decided to take his shotgun out of his car and hide it behind the boxes inside the warehouse. There was evidence that the trailer's sliding glass door had been tampered with, and since the shotgun was not fingerprinted thoroughly, and the empty shell casings were never fingerprinted at all, it could not be proven or disproven that the items had been handled by an outside party. Well, needless to say, the prosecution felt that the defense's theory was absurd, and did not find it believable that intruders would show up at the Hansen residence to commit a crime without bringing any weapons of their own, and rely entirely on Donnie's shotgun and cans of gasoline. The trial lasted 2 months, and in the end, the jury ultimately sided with the defense. On June the 16th, after deliberating for 6 hours, they wound up finding Donnie not guilty on all counts. According to the prosecutor, many of the jurors would tell him that they still believed Donnie was responsible, but did not feel his guilt had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The Hansen family was initially supportive of the verdict, but upon further reflection, they ultimately came to believe that Donnie was involved in the crime, or at the very least, knew what happened. Hans and Betty suspected that in addition to Jill and Julie, Donnie had planned to kill them as well, in order to collect on a large life insurance policy Hans had taken out for the family. Donnie would become completely estranged from his mother and stepfather, and he eventually moved out of the area and changed his name. Hans and Betty filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Mad River Community Hospital over Julie's death, alleging that malpractice had taken place, and Julie died as a result of the hospital's negligence. After years of delays, the case would finally be heard at a civil trial in January of 1992, but unfortunately for the Hansons, the jury sided in the hospital's favor. Since double jeopardy prevented Donnie from ever being charged with his sister's murders again, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department did not bother to reopen the investigation, but Hans and Betty believed there was a possibility that others were involved in the crime, as Betty had seen Donnie yelling at someone to get out of here right after the fire started. Ever since the twins were children, their parents had saved up $50,000 for them to attend college, and they now hoped to use it as reward money for information. The case would be featured on the tabloid TV show Hard Copy in May of 1992, and a year and a half later, in November of 1993, it was profiled on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. While Donnie agreed to be interviewed for the segment, he requested that the show obscure his face and alter his voice in order to protect his identity, but he wound up changing some details of his original story. Even though the scenario presented at trial was that Donnie was awakened by the sound of a shotgun blast, he now said that he never heard any shots at all. While Donnie had originally stated that he hid his shotgun in the warehouse because he feared he would get blamed for the crime, his new story was that he moved it there to prevent it from being stolen. In spite of these inconsistencies, Donnie continued to maintain his innocence and denied any involvement in the crime. Even though there has always been speculation that other suspects were complicit in the murders, after nearly 35 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who actually killed Jill and Julie Hansen. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, before I start talking about this case, here's a list of some of the most controversial examples of defendants who were acquitted of murder. O.J. Simpson, Casey Anthony, Lizzie Borden, Donnie Hansen? Okay, obviously, Donnie Hansen is nowhere near as famous as those other examples I just listed, but I would definitely say it's one of the more surprising acquittals I've ever come across at a murder trial. Even though there seemed to be pretty damning evidence against Donnie, which could not be adequately explained, 12 jurors only had to deliberate for 6 hours before they decided to find him not guilty. Now, I'm definitely a big believer in reasonable doubt, and feel that if a juror thinks there's any doubt whatsoever that the defendant committed the crime, they should vote to acquit. Apparently, some of the jurors in this case still believe that Donnie was responsible, or at the very least, involved in the crime, but they just did not feel that the prosecution proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. I have covered quite a few cases on this podcast where a defendant went on trial and was found not guilty, and while I personally believe that some of these defendants were guilty all along, I was able to understand why the jury reached the verdict that they did. But with Donnie Hansen, I'm not so sure. The biggest point of reasonable doubt were the eyewitness sightings of the two unidentified men near the trailer while it was on fire, but I don't know if that's strong enough to overcome the mounds of evidence which implicated Donnie. I mean, the Unsolved Mystery segment presented a full reenactment of the alternate scenario Donnie's defense team presented in favor of his innocence, and when you watch this whole sequence of events from beginning to end, it's hard to imagine how a jury could possibly believe it. I do acknowledge that even if Donnie was guilty, there is a good chance he had accomplices, and I guess I can see how this might have created a dilemma for the jury. While the murder weapon could be linked to Donnie, it could not be conclusively proven if Donnie himself used it. It's possible that even if Donnie was complicit, it was his accomplices who fired the shots into Jill and Julie. Technically, Donnie was not charged with a conspiracy to commit murder. He was charged with committing the murders himself, so the jury might have thought this uncertainty created enough reasonable doubt for an acquittal, even if they did not personally believe Donnie was innocent. Well, no matter which way you look at it, even if Donnie is guilty, this is still a pretty bizarre crime, and there are a number of unanswered questions. There weren't many people featured on Unsolved Mysteries whom I felt more sympathy for than Hans and Betty Hansen. They had to experience an unimaginable tragedy as they not only lost two daughters, but had to come to terms with the fact that their own son was likely involved in the crime. Even though Hans was technically Donnie's stepfather, he had raised him since he was around 2 or 3 years old and shared this heartbreaking line during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, quote, "This has been a real tragedy for us because we have lost 3 out of our 4 children out of this. 2 of them are dead, and Donnie's dead to me, because I do feel he was 100% responsible for this, whether he pulled it off 100% himself or not." End quote. I would be interested to know when the Hansons ultimately came to this realization, because Betty did say that she was initially happy when Donnie was acquitted. I've seen a number of cases in which a murderer's family sticks by them and refuses to believe they're guilty in spite of overwhelming evidence, but it seems like Hans and Betty reached the point where they realized that there was no way Donnie could have been innocent in all this. Since Donnie cannot be charged with this crime again because of double jeopardy, I can understand why his refusal to come clean would lead to estrangement from his family. If he did have accomplices and someone else pulled the trigger, they could technically still face justice for what they did, but Donnie refuses to name them or acknowledge any involvement. Like I mentioned earlier, by the time Donnie appeared on Unsolved Mysteries, he had moved out of the area and changed his name, so during his interview, his face was shown in silhouette, and his voice was digitized, and he really seemed to like using the word ludicrous.
"The accusations that I know what went on that night are absolutely ludicrous."
Of course, when asked to account for the many discrepancies in his original story, Donnie really didn't do a very good job explaining them and made himself look even worse. I think that if you were to take a poll among Unsolved Mysteries fans about Donnie's guilt or innocence, virtually none of them would vote that he's innocent, but the full extent of his involvement in this crime is not so clear-cut. As far as the rest of the Hansen family, it sounds like Hans, Betty, Jill, and Julie were all considered to be genuinely nice people within the community. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Hans said that even though the twins were popular in school, they also acted very friendly and sympathetic towards underdogs and would befriend anyone. There's virtually no information out there about the surviving Hansen daughter, Becky, but I would be really curious to know what the family dynamic was like with Donnie. If you look up online discussions about this case, you'll find a few comments from people who claim to have known the Hansons personally and say nice things about them, but they don't speak all that glowingly about Donnie, and you get the impression that he was pretty much the black sheep of the family. I don't know if he had a history of trouble before this crime took place, but I'd love to know if there were any warning signs to suggest that he was the type of person who was capable of murdering his own family. The most prominent theory about a potential motive for Donnie is that he wanted to collect on a life insurance policy his stepfather had, but even if he had managed to wipe everybody out at the trailer that night, he still would have had to split the insurance money with his surviving sister, Becky. And if Donnie had accomplices, they presumably would have demanded a cut of the money as well. We know that Jill and Julie were shot, whereas Hans and Betty were not, but was this an intentional choice, or did Donnie just not get the opportunity to kill his mother and stepfather as well? The fact of the matter is that Donnie lived in an entirely different town and had stopped by to visit his family, so if he was a completely innocent victim, it's quite a coincidence that they would happen to be attacked on the one night when Donnie was staying there. Now, I'm going to go over the scenario presented by Donnie's defense team at his trial, which involved two random intruders breaking into the trailer and committing the crime. I'm glad that Unsolved Mysteries presented a reenactment of this scenario, because when you watch it unfold on screen, it gives you a pretty good idea of how absurd this whole thing really is. And remember, it doesn't sound like the defense ever presented a potential motive for why these two intruders would decide to perform a home invasion on the Hansons, a well-liked family who did not seem to have any known enemies. The story goes that the perpetrators showed up at the Hanson trailer at 3 a.m. without bringing any weapons of their own, but by pure luck, Donnie just happened to have a shotgun, shells, and two full cans of gasoline inside his car, which he had borrowed or purchased during the preceding days. Man, don't you just love it when you plan a home invasion, and the victims are courteous enough to leave you the items to use outside their residence? These men then break inside and start pouring gasoline all over the trailer while Donnie is sleeping right there on the couch and somehow manage not to wake him up. When Julie suddenly walks out into the hallway, one of the intruders uses Donnie's shotgun to fire a shot into her abdomen before starting a fire and fleeing the trailer. When you watch the scene in the reenactment, you'll see that when the shot is fired, the gunman is literally standing only inches away from Donnie while he's waking up on the couch, yet he somehow does not notice Donnie or just decides to completely ignore him and not shoot him too. The most ridiculous part of this scenario is that Donnie supposedly tended to his wounded sister and moved Julie's body onto the porch before helping his parents with the fire, which would explain why Julie wound up crawling to the vacant lot across the road. But the problem is that at no point before he was arrested or put on trial for murder did Donnie tell his parents or anybody else that he witnessed Julie get shot by this mysterious intruder, which seems like a pretty important detail to share if both your sisters have been murdered and your family's home burned down. Remember, during the chaos while they were attempting to put out the fire, Hans said that he asked Donnie if he had seen the twins, and Donnie replied no. It was only after Julie was discovered in the lot when Donnie changed his story and said that he had gotten her out of the trailer, yet he didn't mention anything about witnessing her get shot, and no one even realized Julie had a gunshot wound until after she was rushed to the hospital and taken into surgery. This would tie into Donnie's problematic story after he was caught breaking into the warehouse to retrieve the shotgun, as he told police he had taken it from his car and hid it there because he feared he would get blamed for the crime. But once again, it was not until after Julie was taken into surgery that anyone even found out a crime had occurred. For all anyone knew, the fire could have just been an accident, yet Donnie's making it his top priority to hide a shotgun in order to avoid being blamed for a shooting no one was even aware had taken place? During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Donnie changed his story and said that he hid the shotgun because he worried it might get stolen. But I just don't see how a normal person would even be thinking of something like that if they were going through such a traumatic ordeal as witnessing their family's home burn to the ground. If the defense's scenario was true, and these intruders took the shotgun from Donnie's car, it was awfully nice of them to put it back there so that Donnie could grab the murder weapon and hide it to avoid being blamed for their shooting. For an innocent person, Donnie sure did a lot to preemptively cover his tracks for a crime he did not even commit. When you break down the defense's alternate scenario from beginning to end, it does seem pretty astonishing that a jury could hear this and vote not guilty. Of course, one of the worst breaks for the prosecution's case was when Julie died in the hospital before she could testify about what she saw at trial. Given the circumstances of how she passed away, it's tempting to believe that someone might have tampered with Julie's intravenous feeding tube to allow the air bubble to enter her heart, but I genuinely believe this was nothing more than an unfortunate freak accident. Donnie had already been arrested by the time Julie's death took place, and if anyone else was involved in this crime, I highly doubt they would have been sophisticated enough to sneak into a hospital to disconnect Julie's IV tube without being seen. That type of covert operation to eliminate a witness is the type of thing you see in movies, but I don't see it happening in a small town in Humboldt County, California. The circumstances of Julie's death were extensively analyzed when Hans and Betty filed a civil lawsuit against the hospital and took them to trial years later, but there's nothing to suggest it was intentional sabotage. But would Donnie's trial have turned out differently if Julie had lived to testify against him? As you recall, Julie said she remembered seeing Donnie's face in the flash of the shotgun blast, but even if her memory was genuine, I'm not sure if this conclusively proves he pulled the trigger. If the Unsolved Mysteries reenactment of the shooting is accurate, the couch Donnie was sleeping on would have been in Julie's line of sight from the hallway, so if another person was standing near Donnie when they fired the shot, it's possible Julie still could have seen Donnie's face in the flash, even if he was not holding the gun. The details are pretty vague, but it sounds like the police did not do a particularly thorough job collecting fingerprints from the shotgun or the empty shells, and since Donnie was not implicated as a potential suspect until days later, I'm sure they never checked his hands for gunshot residue right after the crime took place. Even if Donnie's prints were on the shotgun or the shells, that hardly implicates him since he borrowed and bought these items, but if they had found fingerprints belonging to anyone else, then that points to another shooter being involved, though it doesn't necessarily clear Donnie. The biggest piece of evidence which got Donnie acquitted was the eyewitness accounts from the neighbors who saw two men standing outside the Hansen residence while it was on fire and heard the sound of a car screeching down the street, which suggests that someone fled the scene. It doesn't sound like the witnesses provided a detailed enough description of the two men for a composite sketch, but I initially wondered if they actually saw Hans and Donnie while they were trying to put out the fire. But Hans is a pretty distinct-looking bald guy, so I think he would have been recognized if one of the men was him. It's also been reported that two men showed up at the scene a few hours later who appeared to have ashes on their clothing, suggesting that they may have already been there while the trailer was on fire. I've never seen this information corroborated, but following Donnie's trial, someone wrote in a letter to the Eureka Times Standard newspaper in which they pointed out the pieces of evidence which leaned away from Donnie, and they mentioned that one of these two men with ashes on their clothing was the stepson of a local deputy. It almost sounded like the writer was trying to imply that the authorities pinned the crime on Donnie in order to protect someone who had a connection to law enforcement. Well, considering all the evidence against Donnie, I certainly don't agree with that assessment, especially since he might never have appeared on law enforcement's radar as a suspect if he hadn't returned to the warehouse to retrieve the shotgun. But I certainly don't rule out the possibility that those two unidentified men could have been Donnie's accomplices. We have the account from Betty that she saw Donnie running out of the trailer and yelling, "Get out of here," right after the fire started. If Donnie had been yelling at intruders he saw on the property, he never told anyone during the early stages of the investigation, which is why I think it's reasonable to assume that Donnie was yelling at someone who assisted him with the crime and wanted them to leave before his family saw them. So if Donnie committed this crime alongside others, you have to ask, what exactly was their plan? I mean, whenever a murder plot doesn't make much sense, I usually just chalk that up to the fact that criminals are often stupid, but it's really hard to figure out what the perpetrators were attempting here. Since all of the items which were used during the commission of this crime, including the shotgun, the shells, and the cans of gasoline, could all be traced back to Donnie, this definitely suggests that he planned the whole thing, so why would he need accomplices in the first place? Donnie lived in Fortuna, which is around 70 miles away from Willow Creek, so it seems to me that if there were others involved, Donnie's most logical course of action would have been to orchestrate a murder-for-hire plot and have his accomplices attack his family on a night when he's at home in Fortuna and has an airtight alibi. Why do this on the one night when Donnie just happened to be staying with his family? If Hans, Betty, Jill, and Julie were all murdered, and Donnie was the sole survivor, he's automatically going to become the focus of the investigation and arouse suspicion. Part of me wonders if Donnie was not planning to have his accomplices do this until after he returned home, but they jumped the gun and screwed up and broke into his family's trailer on the wrong night when he happened to be there. Given how nonsensical this whole plan seemed to be, that probably would have been par for the course. It's bad enough that Donnie purchased items which could be traced back to him, but I think it's particularly stupid that he would borrow the shotgun from a friend of his. Even if Donnie had been able to get rid of the murder weapon, this person is bound to be asking him for their gun back at some point and might become suspicious after learning that Donnie's sisters just happened to be killed with a shotgun only 3 days after Donnie borrowed it. I have read some gossip online, though I'd never seen this information substantiated, that Donnie had issues with drugs during this time period, and this entire crime might have been orchestrated because he owed a drug debt to someone. If the whole thing was drug-related, that might explain the desperation and lack of logic associated with many of Donnie's actions. This just did not come across as a well-thought-out murder plot, and the vast majority of the time, anyone who makes these type of stupid mistakes would wind up in prison. So it seems like Donnie just got incredibly lucky. If those neighbors had not reported seeing the two men near the trailer, there might have been less reasonable doubt in the jury's minds. It's possible that the main reason Donnie had accomplices is that he wanted his family dead, but just lacked the stomach to kill them himself, which is why he enlisted the help of others. Perhaps the original plan was to burn down the trailer with Hans, Betty, Jill, and Julie inside and hope they would all get killed in the fire. Even though Donnie brought along a shotgun as a backup plan, he may have hoped it wouldn't have to be used. If a trailer fire was the exact cause of death, it wouldn't have looked implausible that Donnie was the only member of the family to survive, since he was sleeping on the couch next to the sliding glass door, and he would have been able to escape quicker than everyone else. Of course, Donnie would still need to get rid of the gas cans, and I'm sure the authorities would find evidence that arson took place, but like I've reiterated many times, it doesn't look like Donnie was a criminal mastermind. But it seems like before this plan was completed, Julie heard something and woke up, and once she went into the hallway, she may have seen something which led to her being shot. We may never know for certain if it was Donnie himself who fired the shot or one of his accomplices, but I'm sure this probably threw the original plan for a complete loop, since the noise woke Hans and Betty up and they were able to escape the burning trailer. What's still not clear to me is when exactly Jill would have been shot. The theory presented by the defense at trial is that one of the intruders remained inside the trailer while Hans, Betty, and Donnie ran to the warehouse to grab the fire extinguishers and use that opportunity to shoot Jill. But that doesn't make sense, because unless this assailant had a personal grudge against the twins, why would they hang around just to murder Jill and not make an attempt to kill the rest of the family? I have seen differing accounts from differing sources about where exactly Jill's body was found, as one source said it was the kitchen area, while another said she was found in a fetal position inside her bedroom closet, and in addition to her gunshot wound, smoke inhalation was one of her causes of death. If true, this would mean that after she was shot, Jill crawled into the closet to hide from the fire before she perished, which is a truly horrifying thought. Even though it's possible Donnie always intended to kill everyone, the fact that he was seen yelling "get out of here" before any attempt was made to shoot Hans and Betty makes me wonder if perhaps the main motive for his plan was to kill his half-sisters, possibly because of some deep-seated hatred he had towards them. So I really have no idea what Donnie has been up to these past 3 decades, and since he changed his name, it's not like you can just search for information about him on Google. If Donnie was the sole perpetrator of this crime, then there really isn't anything else that can be done due to double jeopardy, but the evidence does suggest that multiple individuals were involved, so theoretically, there are others who could be brought to trial for these murders. But given the amount of time that has passed, unless Donnie decides to fess up and share the complete truth, we may never know the exact details of what happened. However, if you happen to have any information about the murders of Jill and Julie Hansen, which point to someone else besides Donnie Hansen being involved, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the kidnapping of Jolynn Rogers, who happened to be the sister of famous professional wrestler Jake the Snake Roberts, and this entire episode not only examines the crime itself, but the troubling history of Jolynn Rogers' entire family and upbringing at the hands of an abusive father. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Sherry C., Joni R., and Carrie C. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, provided that it's safe enough to travel there, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLE21. That's COLE21. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.